where in 1976 and 1978, the Supreme Court in the Buckley and First National Bank versus Bilotti decisions ruled that for, in the first case, billionaires, and in the second case, corporations, to give enough money to a politician that they basically owned that politician was no longer considered corruption or bribery. It was now considered free speech and protected by the First Amendment. The Republican Party jumped on this in 78 and said, okay, cool, we're open for business. Billionaires, corporations, come by us. The Democratic Party at that point in time was still largely funded by the organized labor. And about a third of Americans were members of unions in 1981 when Reagan came into office. By 96, you had union membership way, way down. It was down around 11 or 12%. Right now, it's a 6% in the private workforce.
Been active union busting. I mean,
right.
That's, yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is how Reagan basically kicked off his presidency, after PATCO. And what the Republicans understood was, certainly they don't like unions, but they weren't interested in destroying unions just out of philosophy. They were trying to kill the funding for the Democratic Party. And they were successful, and which is why in 92, Bill Clinton had to sit down with Al Fromm and develop this thing called the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, and say, okay, we can't take, there's not enough money in the unions to fund a campaign anymore, so we're going to pick clean industries. And if you're old enough to remember the 90s, the Clinton was, particularly in the 96 election, was pitching this idea of blue collar jobs are the jobs of the past, the new jobs are the white collar jobs, you don't need a union for those jobs. And it was because the Democratic Party had started taking massive amounts of money from tech and from banking and from insurance and from pharma, from the so-called clean industries. And I think, again, that disillusioned people. They saw the Democratic Party no longer being the party of Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society and the New Deal, and instead turning basically into a kind of a Richard Nixon version of the Republican Party, a Republican Party light by today's standards.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also go into the Koch brothers. They funded an effort called ALEC. We actually did an investigation here at Cable on that, and that is the American Legislative Exchange Council. What was their role in voter suppression?
They authored, they provide, in ALEC meetings twice a year, you get state legislators from all over the country who get together with lobbyists, and the meetings are typically one-on-one, one lobbyist for every state legislator. They're not stuck together all the time, but the lobbyists present what's called model legislation that the state legislators very often take right back to the state house in their particular states and submit unaltered as bills. And they became most famous for this around the Stand Your Ground laws after Trayvon Martin was murdered. But the thing that has affected this is they came up with model legislation for voter ID laws and for, basically systems for purging voting.
So you write early in the book about the fact that, hey, the people who elected Donald Trump are basically the people who didn't vote, right? Or didn't get to vote, or votes didn't count.
Yes.
Only 26% of the electorate elected Donald Trump, even though, he lost by over 3 million popular votes. Part of that victory was the result of the purging voters that we talked about just a little while ago.
Yes.
Mostly people of color, younger, poorer voters. Is that coordinated centrally, or is it something that is done state by state?
Both. It started out state by state. After Bush's success in 2000, in 2002, they brought along the provisional ballot scam into the Help America Vote Act. And by 2004, it had become a thing, a big thing in Republican states. In Ohio, for example, the 2004 exit polls showed John Kerry walking away with it. Yet John Kerry lost Ohio. Jonathan Edwards was on my show when that happened. He was spitting mad. He at Kerry for not wanting to fight this thing, he ended up having his own problems, but that's a whole other story. That was when we really started seeing redshift move out of just Florida, out of an obscure state here and there. And now we're seeing redshift in many of the Republican-controlled states that might even be close to being swing states.
Tom, is that due to Republican secretaries of state?
Yes, purging voting lists. Yes.
And including Brian Kemp in Georgia.
He was a master of it. You know, he was a master.
Now, besides voter suppression, you list voter suppression was one of three elements you list in the book as a way of keeping mostly Republicans, but very rich Americans, American oligarchs, in fact, in power. Can you talk about the role of the others on the list? One of them is explicit and overt racism, white supremacy, in other words, and the other is massive disinformation campaigns, which we saw quite a bit of in 2016 and might see quite a bit of in 2020.
Not might. We are.
We already are.
Yeah, yeah. I actually have seen several news reports that it's already begun.
Oh, yeah. It began months ago. And, you know, I mean, the Trump campaign is, I think, 1,400 different Facebook ads that all kind of look the same if you were to look at them. But, you know, one's targeted for men who own motorcycles and one's targeted for, you know, women who have two children and under the age of whatever. You know, I'd say
they get granular.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, granular. Mark Zuckerberg is really helping these guys.
Yes, he is.
And they're filled with lies. So we've got this massive disinformation campaign coming out of the Republican Party and the Trump campaign. Then you've got what appear to be bots on the backside, you know, clearly in the campaign in 2016 coming out of Russia. And now maybe
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, well, Seth Abramson wrote a book called Proof of Conspiracy. And he says that the four countries that funded bots and basically helped Trump steal the election through disinformation campaigns were the Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Russia, and Israel. So not, although the Israel part was not the country, it was people within the country. But that, those were the four major foci, according to him. I haven't independently done that research, but his book is pretty impressive. So, yeah, there's this massive disinformation campaign going on right now. I'm on the White House email list and the Trump campaign list, and it's shocking the stuff I get every day. It's like, you know, the world is upside down. Things are inside out.
Black is white. White is black.
Yeah,
I mean, it's really crazy. Yeah, I'm one of those people who kind of believes that the upcoming election is going to be the one that determines whether we're able to save our democracy.
I think you're right.
I really feel strongly about that. And you have a subtitle on your book, Who Stole Your Vote and How to Get It Back? I'm always most concerned with what people can do to fight back and to make sure their vote counts. And maybe to, in my particular case, I come from a family who is a bunch of Trump supporters. And how do you talk to folks and make them see the disinformation, you know, especially when they're not reading regularly and not investigating, you know, what can we do?
With regard to disinformation, I think, you know, probably the best thing you can do is introduce them to progressive media, you know, whether it's websites or, you know, shows like yours, stations like KABU, things like that. With regard to getting your vote back, I think the main thing, I am shocked by the number of people, Democrats, participating Democrats, elected Democrats that I've talked to in the last couple of years, particularly when I started researching for this book, who have no idea about provisional ballots, who didn't know that these are just placebo ballots, who didn't know that that these voting purges weren't just cleaning up the rolls from people who died or moved out of state, but actually were part of a systematic multi-decade program that the Republican Party has in place and is going to be continuing. It's at the core of what they're doing. So we need to educate people. We need to wake them up. And you know, it's not a problem in Oregon, frankly. It's not a problem in almost...
Preaching to the choir
here. Virtually all of the democratically controlled states, not a problem. You don't see redshift in these states. But in states where you've got a Republican Secretary of State, a Republican governor, and both houses controlled by Republicans, or even one house controlled by Republicans, if you've got a state that is on the verge of being purple. I mean, you know, Florida, for example, it went to Trump by 1 point. A year before that, it went to Obama by 1 point. And Texas is becoming like this, Arizona, New
Colorado.
Mexico. Colorado, yeah. Absolutely. In these states, we need to have people so sensitized to these issues that if somebody hands them a provisional ballot, they pull out a bullhorn and start absolutely raising hell and telling everybody they know. We've got to get the word out about this.
Now, Oregon has several, you recommend in the book, actually, Tom, several solutions to the current problem.
Mail-in voting here.
We have automatic voter registration, which you mentioned. The mail-in voting and paper ballots.
Yes.
And there were several others on your list, too. We had a Secretary of State candidate here, Mark Hass, and he made a point about ranked choice voting. What do you see the benefits there?
Ranked choice voting is generally opposed by the Republican and Democratic parties institutionally because it helps broaden the range of candidates. Basically, For example, in the 2000 election, I lived in Vermont, so I felt safe to vote for Ralph Nader in the election. You know, I've known Ralph for a lot of years. I like Ralph.
I voted for him too. My wife won't let me forget it.
That's right, and same here. Actually, yes. Louise voted for Al Gore, but we were in Vermont. You know?
Right.
So if we had ranked choice voting in Vermont in that election, I could have said, okay, Ralph Nader's my first choice, but Al Gore's my second choice. So if Ralph Nader had not remained viable in the election. And like with the, we all are familiar with these terms now from the Iowa primary. You know, if you don't hit 15%, you're not viable, right? If he was no longer viable, then my first choice would have been scratched off, and my vote would have been registered for Al Gore. That's basically how ranked choice voting or instant runoff voting works. And what it does is it allows people to participate as third and fourth party candidates or independent candidates in elections, or to have multiple parties so that we can have like a parliamentary system where you have, you know, a half a dozen or more parties like you have in France or Germany or Israel. And it functions. Right now, if you've got a third party, Jill Stein is still getting attacked for making Donald Trump president, and Ralph Nader is still getting attacked for making George Bush president. I don't buy either of those, but there's a certain amount of reality to it, and particularly in swing states. If you're voting for a third party candidate, you're typically voting for the Republican. And so, you know, ranked choice voting is a great idea, and I'd love to see it take place here. It's in 300 communities around the United States. San Francisco is the largest. And it works really, really well.
They have that in New Hampshire or Vermont, ranked choice?
No, but they're starting it in Maine.
And you also mentioned in the book that it also helps neutralize, which I think one of the biggest problems we have is the Citizens United decision,
yes.
Where there's all this money coming in, dark money. And you said in the book, you said it neutralizes money because it's hard to run an attack ad when you have numerous opponents.
It diffuses the field.
Diffuses,
somewhat,
yes.
Yeah.
And you're also very supportive of abolishing the Electoral College as well.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, it's kind of funny because as I understood it from civics class, remember civics class? Did anybody take civics anymore?
Yeah.
In civics class, you know, the Electoral College was supposed to protect us from somebody like Donald Trump,
yeah.
right? But that's not how it's turned out.
You go back and you read the second and third week of July in 1787 in Philadelphia, the debates in the Constitutional Convention. And there were basically two reasons for the Electoral College. The first was to prevent a scoundrel. And it was kind of a variation on the second, which was that not everybody could get to Washington, D.C. And we were at that point in time, one of the largest geographically Western countries in the world. I mean, you know, you could fit a lot of European countries just in Georgia. So, you know, the problem was if you had the word that was used by, I think it was George Mason in the debate, was a drunkard who was, you know, a candidate for president. The electors, I mean, if you lived in Georgia, you would elect a local person. They couldn't, the Constitution says the person cannot have ever held elective office. So no dog in the game, right? Or fight, whatever the terrible anti-animal cliche is.
Right.
but you get my point.
No
so,
dog in the fight.
Right, yeah. So that person would then go to Washington, D.C. and meet the candidates and would bring with them the fact that their people back in Georgia said, yeah, please vote for, you know, John Adams or Thomas Jefferson. But if he met them both and thought, you know, this guy's a drunkard and the other one isn't, he could change his vote. That's built into it. It's kind of a door that swings both ways. It's a safety valve, you know. And you know, but that was a time when it took 3 days for the news to travel from one end of the country to the other, and when it was virtually impossible to meet the candidates. That has, and you could argue that the Electoral College served us well during the first half century of this country, but it has had the opposite effect since then. I mean, you know, George W. Bush lost the popular vote by 500,000 votes and should not have become president as a result of that. And obviously Donald Trump, 3 million votes. There is a program, it's called National Popular Vote. The website is nationalpopularvote.com, where when enough states to equal 200 and I think it's 90 electoral votes that you have to have to become president, or maybe 270, forgive my math challenge here, then all these states that have signed this agree that all their electoral votes will go to whoever got the majority of the votes. And they're at 170 right now, so they need to pick up some new states.
Yeah, actually, Virginia is on the verge.
Yes.
Very close.
Their legislature just voted on it.
Well, Tom, the book is just incredibly relevant. And like Michelle said, you do go back to 1789, to the Constitution. Well, we're running out of time, so we can't even get to the way the Senate was originated.
Oh, yeah.
I had a friend today saying, why do a few people in Kentucky... deciding what's happening in the whole country. You know, it just doesn't seem fair. But thanks so much for coming into KABU today.
My pleasure, Ken and Michelle. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been talking with Tom Hartman, author of the new book, The Hidden History of the War on Voting, Who Stole Your Vote, and How to Get It Back. You can find out more about Tom, his new book, and all his work at tomhartman.com. This is Michelle Coppola and Ken Jones for KABU's News in Depth.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community. Oh,